Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Growth of the U.S. economy slows.
Does this mean we're going to slide back into recession?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, happy Friday. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, July 30th. The U.S. economy grew in the last 3 months by 2.4%, and that's down significantly from the quarter before.
We got that word from the government this morning. Also, BP's soon-to-be ex-chief executive has some choice words on the way out. And from Apple Jacks to Honey Smacks, are products you know selling fast or slow? But first, we've got the first assessment of how the economy did in the second quarter. The government today reported the nation's gross domestic product rose by 2.4%. That's about what analysts were expecting, but it's slower than first quarter growth and way below what we would be seeing as strong growth. David Kelly is chief market strategist for J.P. Morgan Chase. He's with us from Boston for some analysis. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So what does 2.4% GDP growth tell you about where we are?
Well, it tells us that we're in a slow but clear recovery from a very deep recession. They did revise the numbers going back a number of years. It shows that this was the worst recession since World War II, but over the last year, we've grown by 3.2%, so that is clear economic growth. It's just not as fast as any of us would like.
Remind us about the GDP, where we get it, and why it's so important to look at.
Yeah, GDP is the best measure we have of how we're all doing in this economy. These are numbers which are released every quarter by the Commerce Department. And what's particularly interesting this morning is they've released numbers going back over the last few years. So we actually get a sense not just of how we're doing right now, but how deep was the recession and how strong is the recovery so far.
And this, by no doubt, is not the last time we're going to hear about second quarter GDP. We'll get further revisions, right, from here on.
That's right. They'll revise the numbers. But the real question is also not just what was going on in the second quarter, but there were a lot of questions about, you know, how much is this economy slowing down? And right now, we do think that there is a soft patch in economic growth, but we believe the economy will regain momentum as we go into next year. So we still think continued growth rather than a double-dip recession.
David Kelly, chief market strategist for J.P. Morgan Chase. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Let's hear some more now on this big GDP report from chief economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. He's our Friday regular. He joins us from New York City. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
This report points right at the American consumer. We just are not spending as much.
Well, that's right. You know, consumers account for about three quarters of the U.S. economy. So obviously the foundation, the most important element. And what's going on is that consumers are still paying down debt. They're paying down credit cards. They're reducing their mortgages. Ultimately, we'll be in better shape. But that's where the growth in the U.S. economy comes from, and it's just not there in the current quarter.
Yeah, we also imported a lot of stuff, and that pulled things down. But what's all this mean, Chris? Are we sliding backward, or is it onward and upward from here?
Well, this is not another recession. I think it's important to keep that in mind. Growth is still positive. It should continue to be positive. It's just sluggish. One bright spot, it may be sluggish enough that it prods policymakers to give us a little more help, probably not from Congress, but maybe from the Fed. We'll get another round of easing to try and get the economy growing at a faster rate.
Yes, another round of easing. In fact, we're about to explore that right now and tell you more about what that means. Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial, thank you.
You're welcome.
So as Chris said, the Federal Reserve has some weapons for kicking the economy back into gear, and these seem to be boiling again. A new report from one of the regional Federal Reserve presidents brings up this idea that the folks who make monetary policy might wage a sort of preemptive war on deflation, falling prices. Here to tell us more about that is Marketplace's Janet Babin. She joins us live. Hello, Janet.
Hey, Bill.
So the big fear, you know, had been inflation. Why the shift now?
Well, since the financial crisis, the Fed's taken all kinds of emergency measures, right? Last year, it bought some $300 billion worth of Treasury securities. And all this stuff sparked controversy from critics that the Fed was basically printing money, you know, to pay for rising budget deficits, and that all this stimulus action could end up making our money worthless and put taxpayers and future generations at risk. And now, as you said, comes this report from James Bullard, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And in it, he warns that these stimulus actions are a double-edged sword that could aggravate this risk of deflation. And this is especially important, Bill, because Bullard's usually on the other side of the debate, worried about inflation. So this could be a bit of a turning point.
Well, let me ask you about deflation, Janet. Speaking as a consumer, don't I kind of want prices to fall so I can spend less on stuff like groceries?
Yeah, you would think, but it's values that fall, like the housing market. Your house isn't worth what you paid for it. I spoke to Mark Vidner this morning. He's a senior economist at Wells Fargo, and he told me that the big problem with deflation is that when prices fall, companies need to reduce wages, but they can't.
What you wind up with is very high unemployment, and that's probably the greatest risk from deflation right now, is that it would create a much deeper recession. And it would be much harder for the United States to get back out of it.
And so the last time this happened, Bill, in the U.S. was in the 1930s during the Great Depression. And then, of course, it happened in Japan during the 1990s, and it took them at least a decade to get over it.
Interesting. Marketplace's Janet Babin. Janet, thanks a lot for that.
Thank you, Bill.
The slow economy equates to smaller contributions into state budgets. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce today holds a conference on underfunded state pension and health benefit plans. Now, at that summit, the chamber says states should do what a lot of private companies do, and that is cut contributions to retirement plans during lean times. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Pension plans for state and local government workers are at least $1 trillion in the red. That's according to the Pew Center on the States. Generous retirement plans were offered to employees who didn't have to pay in. Governments were responsible for pension payments, but they didn't put enough money in. To make matters worse, fund investments tanked during the financial crisis. What to do now? Aaliyah Wong of the Chamber of Commerce says future state workers will have to share the burden.
There will be more cost sharing, which will mean, you know, if you want a richer benefit, you have to make more of a contribution from your own paycheck.
Joshua Rao teaches finance at Northwestern University. He says if states don't act, they'll go Greek.
We will run into a Greece-style debt crisis in states like Illinois and New Jersey, and where basically the state ceases to function.
Some states have gotten the message. Pew says 15 states have raised the retirement age for new workers or curbed their benefits. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 30th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. It's only been a few days since the British oil giant BP announced Tony Hayward would step down as CEO. Now he's given his first interview since that announcement. In the Wall Street Journal, Hayward says he thinks he was made scapegoat for the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster and for BP's response. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Steve.
What else is Hayward saying in this article?
He claims he handled the crisis rather well, although he does regret some of the comments he made at the time. He also says he actually wanted to stay on as CEO, but felt he had to agree to quit for the sake of the company. Because I love the company, he says, I must leave it. He also reveals that BP's polling shows that the company's poll rating has begun to recover and that it is still rated more highly than Goldman Sachs. I'm not sure how reassuring that is for BP.
It sounds like he has a lot to say. So I want to talk about BP's role, Stephen, in the release of the convicted terrorist in the Pan Am Lockerbie bombing. Now, Hayward refuses to testify to U.S. lawmakers, and British and Scottish officials now are not cooperating either. What's the next step there?
Well, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Robert Menendez, says he wants to bring his inquiry to British soil. As you say, his committee wants to find out whether there was a link between BP winning a $900 million oil and gas deal with Libya and the early release of the Libyan man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing, the bombing of that plane over Scotland in 1988, in which 270 people died. Well, the head of the Scottish government, Alex Salmond, says his ministers won't take part in a formal Senate inquiry wherever it's held.
My ministers, my officials, are responsible to the Parliament and people of Scotland. They're not, with enormous respect to Senator Menendez, responsible to the American Senate.
All this is more unwelcome publicity for BP, which, under that $900 million deal, begins drilling in Libyan waters shortly.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Budweiser has lost a battle to have its name trademarked in Europe. The American brand has fought for years against a Czech beer maker called Budweiser Budvar. That Czech company can now call itself Bud in some major European countries. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
Both beers have the same name, but one's a light lager, originally from St. Louis, and now owned by the global giant AB InBev, and the other is a darker beer, steeped in small-town Eastern European tradition. Larry Nelson is the editor of Brewer's Guardian, an international magazine for the drinks industry.
Budvar is a small Czech brewery with a production of roughly 1/1,000th of what AB InBev would produce worldwide.
Now, the highest court in Europe has decided the American Budweiser brand can't use its name in Germany or Austria, two very important beer markets. It's not known yet how the company will market itself there. This dispute's been going on for 14 years, but the root of the problem comes from the fact that Budweiser simply means beer from the town of Budweiss, and with Czech beer growing in popularity, the global brand didn't want any misunderstanding. Nelson says the decision won't impact Budweiser too much.
You're talking about a small brewery that has a great product but limited resources. At the end of the day, it's still going to come down to marketing muscle.
Most other European countries, including the UK, allow both companies to use the name. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
New rules for air cargo start next week. All shipments that fly along with passengers on commercial aircraft must be screened for security. Now, the shipping industry has had a few years to work up to the new rules, but there have been a few setbacks. Marketplace's Eve Troh reports.
Most travelers have no idea the belly of their plane is filled with much more than luggage.
Virtually all passenger planes have cargo. It might be electronics, it might be food products, any kind of merchandise.
Peter Quinter is a customs lawyer in Florida, a major shipping hub.
Most passenger airlines, a huge percentage of their revenues and more of their profit comes from the cargo than it does from the passengers.
But all that cargo is a security risk.
So it might go from Hong Kong to Singapore, Singapore to London, London to New York.
Homeland Security sees those transfers as weak links where someone could sneak a bomb onto a plane. Up to now, only a percentage of cargo has been screened. Starting Sunday, every shipment must be certified. It's taken years to build systems to do this, says David Brooks. He's president of American Airlines Cargo Division.
There hasn't been screening devices that can accommodate the small envelope all the way up to pallets that weigh 10,000 pounds that we may get.
Picture those X-ray conveyor belts for luggage, but big enough for a hot tub, and with advanced technology to detect explosives. Brooks says American Airlines alone spent $10 million on new screening gear. It will charge clients for the service, and those companies will pass the cost along to you and me.
Cell phones, the computers, all the things that tend to go by air, at the end of the day, it's going to be the consumers who are going to see more cost.
But that's the price of increased security. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace.
Get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. In a more than $600 million deal, the Walt Disney Company has agreed to sell its Miramax Films unit to an investor group led by the construction magnate Ron Tudor. Miramax's library includes some Oscar winners, including My Left Foot, Pulp Fiction, and Good Will Hunting. Porter Bibb is managing director at Media Tech Capital Partners. He's with us live from Long Island with the latest and some analysis this morning. Welcome to Marketplace, sir.
Great to be here.
All right. Why would Disney want to sell Miramax if it had these big hits from back in the 90s? Seems like they're pretty valuable, right?
Well, Bob Iger is very sharply focused on Disney brands, Disney and Pixar. And
this is the head of Disney, right, Bob Iger?
That's correct. And he wants to make films that have merchandising and theme park ancillary revenue potential. Miramax is not part of that. It's a mature entity. He decided over a year ago to run it down. It's got no employees now. It's 700 pictures in the film library, and Ron Tudor is going to have to pick that up and build it from there.
Miramax founders, these are the brothers, Harvey and Bob Weinstein, tried to retake control, right? What happened there?
Well, they could not raise the capital. The price, the ultimate price was $665 million. Disney always said they wanted $700. They didn't get it. The best that the Weinsteins could muster was $565, $100 million less than Ron Tudor put on the table.
And the overall strategy, you mentioned, you know, theme parks and things like that. Disney also has Pixar and these animation film units as well, right?
Exactly. And all of those have many, many revenue streams. They can make theme park attractions. They can merchandise them through the Disney retail stores. They can play them on the Disney channels. You can't put No Country for Old Men on the Disney Channel.
I would imagine not. All right, Porter Bibb joining us from New York. We do appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 30th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Lift up the hood on your car these days, and it's hard to find the spark plugs. Even mechanics might be lost under there unless they have the specs from the automaker. And unless those mechanics work for dealerships, they might not be able to get those specs. Well, today, the Massachusetts legislature could vote on a bill to force car makers to share repair information with independent mechanics. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch has our story.
Jeff McLeod is vacationing with his family on a remote New England lake. The 2004 Kia Sedona they drove to get there is working now, but before the trip, its check engine light lit up. McLeod's trusty mechanic, Tom's service station, plugged into the car's computer for the error code. But Tom wasn't allowed to look up what it meant. McLeod had to take the minivan to the dealer for that.
It made me uncomfortable that somebody that had done that amount of work for me over the years was not able to do this.
Cars have gotten so complicated, repair shops are clueless unless they have the flowchart to troubleshoot these error codes and software glitches.
It's a puzzle. All we want is the directions to put the puzzle back together.
Barry Steinberg runs a Boston area repair shop. He says he needs the Right to Repair Act to force automakers to give out diagnostic information, or he'll go out of business. He points to an older Pontiac that one of his workers is fixing.
There's just so many of those Grand Prix left. I mean, when they wear out, they're going to be replaced by 2005, 2006, 2010, 2015 cars. There's going to be fewer cars that we can fix.
It's like knocking on Coca-Cola's door and saying, hey, I am a little cola place down the street. My cola isn't selling that well. What's the formula to Coca-Cola? Give it to me.
Ernie Bach Jr. runs the top-performing Honda dealership in the world. Dealers, he says, have to invest in costly equipment and sophisticated training.
We don't call them mechanics. They're technicians. They're like surgeons. I mean, this is extremely complicated stuff. This is not about willy-nilly giving out information and having any Tom, Dick, and Harry work on it.
Dealerships make more of their money nowadays from follow-up service than from car sales. So Bach Jr. says if the bill becomes law, expect both sides to rev up for a court fight. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
This weekend, tens of thousands of shoppers will converge on the Renegade Craft Fair in San Francisco. This is a fair devoted to do-it-yourself crafts. Reporter April Dembosky tells us the recession has been a boon to the DIY movement.
Danny Orendorf organizes the Renegade Craft Fair. He says the traditional hipster clientele can still get $6 wallets made of duct tape. But now there's also high-end items like ceramic serving platters for $200.
Hand-in-hand with the introduction of different products and different items that are a little more expensive came consumers that were also maybe from a higher tax bracket.
The recession turned many unemployed hobbyists into full-time artists. Jen Hewitt discovered silk screening when she was laid off in 2008. She found a new job, but then quit so she could spend more time making tote bags and note cards.
If I decided 5 years down the line that I wanted to go back to work full time, because the economy has been so bad, it doesn't look so horrible for me to have had a year of unemployment and then, you know, say a year or two of silk screening.
But she's hoping her printmaking business takes off so she can be done with the 9-to-5 for good. I'm April Dymbosky for Marketplace.
And finally, here is the week's tastiest business news in a morsel called the Marketplace Minute. We got financial information from some major corporations. Colgate did so-so in terms of selling Dynamo and Speed Stick and Toms of Maine. They only saw a modest gain in Handy Wipes and Ambisol and Ultra Bright and Fab and all the soaps and toothpaste that they sell. Profits soared at Sony, Shell, Motorola, Mitsubishi. Boeing sales were kind of squishy. Kellogg said the other day sales were blah for Special K and Apple Jacks and Honey Smacks and Mini Wheats and other treats like Pop-Tarts and Cruncheroos and Cinnamon Marshmallow Scooby-Doos. Lockheed did succeed. Exxon, Avon, yes, indeed, they did. And so did Conoco. Hyundai, yes. Nintendo, no. The final name I have in mind lost more than all those firms combined. It can't be a thrill to lose $17 billion, but then don't do the drill if you can't clean the spill. For the 411 on the GDP, go to marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.